Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mark, we're back in business.
We are back in business. That's a good thing, right, Mona?
It is. John, you got it right.
Yes, it's an amazing decision. Great work by all the lawyers. So I think it's the correct decision, and it was vindicated by the judges granting the temporary restraining order.
For the person that's listening to the show for the first time, John was on the last episode and basically predicted this would happen right at this timing. So, of course, after the show, I'm going to ask him when my 401k is going to come back. But, John, yeah, you hit it right on the head. Yeah, so obviously we have John Pratt joining us back on this episode, but we also have another return guest sharing their expertise to give us some more insight into what it means to be back in business.
Mark, it's a bit more than just insight that Ron's firm are basically attorneys for the one of the many of the parties.
I didn't know that.
Ron, welcome again.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. And yes, we are co-counsel for IIUSA, the Regional Center. And we're very pleased that a lot of the arguments that we made on behalf of IIU were accepted by the judge and became part of his decision granting the preliminary injunction.
What does that mean? I mean, it means that the regional centers are now back in business, right?
Yeah, it really does mean that, Mona. So we all expected we were back in business when the new law passed. And we needed to wait 60 days for the effective date. And then we assumed on day 61, everything starts moving. And then all of a sudden, the Immigration Service did the website posting saying, too bad, all of the 630 regional centers are deauthorized. And we thought that was ridiculous. And we ended up filing litigation to hopefully get a court say it was ridiculous. And the court agreed. So the bottom line is everything has been stopped because the Immigration Service said all of the regional centers have lost their designation. Once the court enjoined the Immigration Service from deauthorizing the regional centers, it now means we're back in business with the new law. And under the new law, every regional center now can proceed to file a project approval application, which is on Form I-956F. And as soon as the project approval application is filed, not approved, but filed, then investors can file I-526 petitions.
I'm going to ask you about that again.
We're back in business.
I'm going to ask you about that again in a moment, Ron. But I want to ask both of you, John and Ron, when we read that decision, I know Rebecca and I were just, wow, this is an amazing decision by Judge Chhabra. And it had unusually detailed language. John, is that usual?
Yeah, in this particular case, obviously, I think that the judge put very specific language addressing the likelihood to succeed in the merits, which indicates the likelihood to succeed in the whole case. The temporary restraining or the injunction was issued, and he was very detailed in announcing the likelihood that ultimately the case will be decided in favor of the plaintiffs, that there was the regional centers were not the author in accordance with the new law, but that they have to comply with some of the integrity measures, et cetera. So yeah. The judge did an amazing job going through the different factors and why it satisfied all corners of the injunction.
Ron, I thought that decision was so good that it really knocked out any chances of appeal.
Well, we don't know that. I'm not going to predict what the government's going to do. They can appeal what they want. But it is, as you said, Mona, it's very unusual. The judge said, and this is an exact quote, the judge said, it's exceedingly likely, if not certain, that the plaintiff will prevail in this case. And that's way beyond what a judge needs to decide to grant a preliminary injunction. That's making it very clear that he thinks that this is an extremely strong case. And hopefully when he finally makes his final decision on summary judgment, it'll be consistent with that. So we feel very good about Judge Chhabria understanding the issues and deciding correctly.
So a lot of people are asking USCIS, what will they do now? Would either of you like to hazard a guess?
On page 13, when the judge says, the agency may do whatever it is reasonably necessary to ensure that the existing regional centers comply with the Integrity Act, and the AILA EB5 committee submitted some questions, because I still think that there's some unanswered questions. And I'd like to get Ron's take on that. For example, what happens to a regional center that has foreign ownership? Can they file I-526s? They may not be in compliance with the new act.
That's a good point. That's a really good point, John.
I would say that the regional centers do not need to do anything to continue their designation. They are designated as regional centers. However, under the new law, they are required to comply with the new law. So if they're a designated regional center, and if they have foreign ownership, they have to divest the foreign ownership in order to be in compliance with the new law. So this decision doesn't say the new law has no impact and regional centers can totally avoid the new law. It doesn't say that at all. It just says that Congress intended this new law to be effective, and all regional centers that were approved before are still approved. And if a regional center needs to file an amendment in order to be in compliance with the new law, such as if there's going to be a change in ownership to get rid of foreign ownership, it seems to me they have to file an amendment in order to be in compliance with the Reform and Integrity Act. But the Reform and Integrity Act states that when you file an amendment, the process continues. So you can still file I-526s even while the amendment application is pending.
Correct. I completely agree with everything that Ron said. What am I to do if I'm an EB-5 practitioner and I have a client that wants to go forward and file an I-526 and says, okay, this is a regional center that I want to file it. This is the project that I like. And I'm just filing it for one investor, and I don't know whether that regional center does or does not have foreign ownership. Should I then, as a careful EB-5 practitioner, pose a series of questions to that regional center in order for me to be sure that if I file the I-526 for my investor client, that regional center is going to be in compliance with the integrity or the new requirements under the law? I would do that if I was a careful EB-5 practitioner before I say to my investor, put your $1 million or your $800,000 to do that. So I agree with everything that Ron said, but I do think that there are some unanswered questions. And as practitioners, some of the practitioners that, you know, when you go ahead and file a relevant I-526, you're going to have to do a little bit of due diligence to ensure that that I-526 will have a likelihood of being approved under the new regime.
Yeah, John, I think it's perfectly appropriate to do as you said. But unless the issuer of the securities is going to commit securities fraud, they would certainly have to include in the offering documents some indication of their ownership. Obviously, if the ownership is clearly in violation of the law, they shouldn't be filing at all. And if they think there's an argument that it's not in violation of the law, presumably all of that would be included in the offering documents and part of the risk disclosures.
I completely agree. It's an amazing win for the industry, and it's an amazing win for EB-5. There's unanswered questions, and the AILA EB-5 committee submitted a series of questions to the IPO in order to determine how USCIS is going to square the Baring 2 decision. Let me just call it the Baring 2 decision with the law.
We also brought up in our last podcast, Ron, what would happen if Baring 1 and to existing regional centers who don't want to be recertified, what happens then? And there are quite a few people who have already sort of decided that they're not going forward.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, Mona. And I think we don't have definite answers. So as far as I'm concerned, no regional center is required to seek designation under the new law. All right. They have their designation that they had under the old law. Now, what if you have a regional center that was designated under the old law that says, well, we have no capability to do all of this securities due diligence and to hire fund administrators and auditors, and we only have one employee and we have multiple projects and we can't do all that. And the Immigration Service hasn't really dealt with that. They have said so far that for grandfathered investors, apparently, even if the regional center is not going to be in compliance with the new law, the grandfathered investors can still be approved, even if the regional center goes out of business. The Immigration Service has said the grandfathered investors can still be approved. I can't make any sense of that. I don't know what the basis for it is under the law. What I think you will see is that regional centers that do not want to do business under the new law, will not be doing any new projects, will not be seeking new investors, may be looking for what I might call backroom assistance to have maybe other regional centers or others who can perform the requirements under the Reform and Integrity Act for them as their back office people so that they don't have to do everything necessary to comply with the new law on their own.
Ron, is that like an expansion of the old regional center franchise idea from a few years ago?
Well, you know, you could look at it that way. A lot of these smaller regional centers, what the Reform and Integrity Act does is it probably puts an end to the concept of rent-a-center, where you have like a regional center with one or two employees and 27 projects. I don't know that model is going to work under the Reform and Integrity Act. So you may have some of those regional centers who are saying, well, I'm not going to staff up in order to comply with all these new requirements, and I don't plan on doing any new projects, but I don't want to leave all of our existing investors out to dry. And what's unknown is how the Immigration Service is going to deal with that. If the regional center says, well, I'm not going to hire fund administrators and auditors and construction consultants, and do securities due diligence and monitor and supervise every sale. I can't do all that. The Immigration Service, what are they going to do? Are they going to say, well, we'll still approve the investors even if you don't do that? Mm. We don't know that at this point.
When USCIS issued their Q&A saying, okay, you have a pre-existing I-526 file, the Q&A was premised on the idea that it was this repeal where they said, okay, fine. We'll continue adjudicating your I-526 even if there's no designated regional center, as long as you created the jobs and the funds were properly spent, et cetera. I hope that the USCIS doesn't reverse that view, because obviously you have some regional centers that had not been terminated and they had non-compliant projects and compliant projects and starting the process of being terminated. And there was no mechanism in existence under the old rules to maybe protect some of those investors in untainted regional centers if the regional center was going to be terminated. I hope that USCIS continues that, because obviously some regional centers that have foreign ownership and nobody wants to buy them, and they're not going to be a procedure. And I would hate to see USCIS terminating those regional centers now and saying that the investors, therefore, could not have their I-526s adjudicated because there's no affiliation with a regional center.
Yeah, what I would say is, just to make it clear, our litigation did not address any of these issues. Whatever the issues are with respect to grandfathered investors and regional centers that are not going to be filing for designation under the new law, are not going to be complying with all the new law requirements, the issue of whether grandfathered investors need a regional center, what if they have a regional center that isn't prepared to comply with all the new RIA requirements, those were issues that existed before our litigation, that exist after our litigation, and our litigation doesn't address it.
Okay, gentlemen, I have a question for you, which is really complexing all of us. So there was a webinar with the Baring brothers just a couple of days ago. And in that webinar, there was a suggestion that we did not need to, if you have a previously filed exemplar, even if it's not approved, there was no need to file a new exemplar. Now, the reason that many of us are confused about this is that even under the old rules, if there are material changes, you have to file a new exemplar. And even just the capital change amount and the TEA, those are changes in itself, material changes. So therefore, you would think that every new project would have to file an exemplar. I understand, Ron, that today you also said again that you do not need to file.
So here's where I come out on that. I think mm-hmm. this is a business decision. So let me explain. The Reform and Integrity Act, and this is something we relied on in our arguments. The Reform and Integrity Act says that if you have an exemplar petition, an I-924, that was approved before June 30, 2021, that still is binding going forward under the new law. So that would seem to say that you don't need to file a new I-956F because the I-924 exemplar is still valid. But it says that that only applies if there's a bunch of exceptions. And one of the exceptions is if there's a material change. Well, then that gets us to the whole question that we've been talking about for about 20 years, which is what is a material change, which has really never been defined. So if you have the exact same project, creating the exact same number of jobs in the same geographical area, taking exactly the same amount of time to construct and the exact same construction expenditures, all the things that are relevant to an EB-5 project, if that's all the same, and the only changes are things to comply with the Reform and Integrity Act, change in investment amount, change in securities compliance procedures, is that a material change? And that is a question that there's no definite legal answer to that. And there is a business decision aspect to that. If you're high risk, you may want to say, well, I don't believe I need to do anything because I don't think this is a material change and we're going to go forward. Or if you're low risk, you're going to say, well, even though there's an argument it's not a material change, I think the safest thing to do is to file the I-956F. And I think the investors will be more comfortable if they know we've done that.
I know I'd certainly be more comfortable if I was one of the investors. What do you think, John?
I completely agree with what Ron said. I mean, I think it's a matter of how you risk or your risk tolerance is. Again, the agency has never properly defined. I mean, in a deposition one time, I argued, "What? Give me the difference between a change and a material change. There has to be a difference," and they couldn't even answer that. So I think that knowing how the agency operated in the past, though, and knowing how the agency operates, obviously there's a lawsuit. And again, it's an amazing victory, that there's no doubt about it. But the agency will still have to implement some issues. So the amounts change, that changes a little bit. I don't think any of these things are material under my estimation, because at the end of the day, you will be deploying EB-5 funds and you will be creating the jobs. Who cares if it was 500 and now it's 1,050,000 or 800? I mean, the bottom line is the essence of the EB-5 is still in compliance, but how the agency is going to treat it, I think, you know, you're going to have to make an educated guess based on your risk tolerance level.
Well, I disagree with both of you, because I do think that the agency is going to come back and say this is in rear, and I think they want their 18,000. You know, it's money at the end of the day.
The problem, though, Mona, that I think that is, okay, whether you are risk averse or not and you go forward, because of the timing, unless they start adjudicating quicker, how the agency is going to treat that, you know, it's to me the $1 million question, in the sense that when will you find out how they're going to treat it, unless they start announcing common sense policies with notice and comment, et cetera.
Ron, we're not over yet, though. I understand there's a hearing on July 14th.
Yeah, that will not affect the preliminary injunction in any way. The main issue for July 14th is whether to accept IIUSA as an intervening plaintiff.
Okay.
So up until now, IIUSA has been amicus curiae and friend of the court, and the judge accepted our brief as amicus curiae. And, you know, when you read his decision, obviously read it carefully and accepted a lot of the points. The judge also took the unusual step of inviting us as amicus curiae to participate in the argument on the preliminary injunction. That's unusual. Now we filed a motion to intervene as a plaintiff so that we want to be part of the case going forward into the summary judgment and to have the effects of the summary judgment apply to the industry. And so we're seeking to intervene, and July 14th is a hearing on our motion to intervene.
But let me ask you this, Ron. Even though IUSA has not been allowed as a plaintiff, the judge did issue the injunction on behalf, not just of Bering, and he gave a very detailed analysis of why he did that. So the injunction already benefits the entire industry.
Yeah, it may be a little less critical because Bering was arguing that it shouldn't affect the whole industry. And we argued strenuously that it should affect the whole industry. And obviously we were successful on that. We still think it's beneficial that if we can be a plaintiff, we will be part of the summary judgment proceedings. And we think we have a significant benefit we can add with the arguments we would make on summary judgment.
What about the other case that was floating around, Ron, that you represented?
That's a case that was filed in the District Court of the District of Columbia, where we represent five of the biggest regional centers. And that is still pending. We also have a motion for preliminary injunction pending and motion for summary judgment pending in that case. Obviously, the urgency of the preliminary injunction is gone, but that case is still pending. We're going to have to see how that goes and what track it takes.
Well, let me ask you this, Ron. On that case, the issue is the same, right? Basically, the same type of bearing claim and the same type of relief, or am I incorrect?
You are correct, John.
John, do you think, and this is going to be a silly question, but do you think USCIS will suddenly decide that it's too expensive to read judges' opinions all the time and they might just take notice of our opinions?
No, I don't think.
We have to continue litigation.
I hear what you're saying, Mona. To them, any change is a material change. They don't understand what the difference is. But I just don't have a lot of faith in the agency. And you know, they keep getting sued and losing. And Bearing's done a great job in different lawsuits. And the whole industry's been doing that. But I just don't see them, fortunately, even though we have a new administration, I don't see them becoming reasonable all of a sudden. Maybe I'm skeptical.
I'm shocked, John. Are you saying that USCIS doesn't have a history of sound business practices and timely and responsive logistics?
Correct. I think IUSA did a great, even before they enacted that, saying some sort of attestation system, et cetera. And they don't pay attention, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. We'll have to see whether they want to appeal it, the injunction or not. I think that if they're reading the tea leaves right, this judge basically said, you're going to lose on this issue.
Yeah.
Set up some common sense, reasonable procedures.
Well, most practitioners have been arguing that there was no notice and comment period, which was required for every form. Are we going to see a notice and comment period here, Ron?
I think it's very possible. I think when the judge talked about a reasoned decision-making process, he specifically mentioned that the Immigration Service has to evaluate any competing concerns or differing opinions. Well, I don't know how it's going to evaluate all of the competing concerns and different opinions unless it seeks comment from stakeholders on what the competing concerns are. So it seemed, and the judge specifically referenced the Administrative Procedure Act. So it seems to me that if they want to come up with procedures, that they have to follow the APA and they have to do notice and comment rulemaking. And that is with the Immigration Service, usually defined by years, not by weeks or months.
Hmm. But John, can't they just go with good cause and implement almost instantaneously?
Could the agency set up some common sense policies short off? Of course they can. That again, to me, one of the unknowns is the following. If you're a risk taker or not, they usually take the position that you have to be approval at the time of filing, and then you cannot make any change after that. So, okay, so whether you're a risk taker or not, you filed it. Then they come up with new rules and policy, you know, notice and comment. But that takes some time. There's a period between the notice and comment, and then for them to implement it, that takes some time. So I'm allowed to file. When they do make the changes, am I allowed to amend my application to conform with their changes? I would say that would be common sense, but the agency's not common sense. I think that goes back to the earlier comment, which is it depends on a discussion with your attorney and your ability to understand risk of how aggressive or safe you want to go forward with a petition, because you know these petitions are pending for years sometimes before you realize that the agency doesn't want to approve it.
I saw a chat group whereby some investors were saying that they thought there was going to be a lot more litigation happening and thereby they should only look at direct projects. It's obviously not the right kind of information that we want to come out, but do you guys have any comments?
Well, I mean, this is not theoretical. We represent lots of investors.
Yes.
And, you know, my advice to investors is nothing involved in EB-5 has no risk. But where we are right now, I think, is in terms of whether if they file a 526 now based on a regional center that has previously been designated, and if the regional center files an I-956F project application, I think it's very low risk that the investor will be denied because of some subsequent litigation. And obviously the project has to comply and the regionals, there's a lot of compliance that, you know, that has to be in order. But I do not anticipate the likelihood that any other litigation will result in properly filed 526s being denied because of some of retroactive application of some subsequent judicial ruling.
Mm. What do you think, John?
I think that obviously in the better regional centers that have more of a track record that will sure comply with the new requirements, I think that's a less risky proposition if you're going with a regional center petition rather than some of the other lesser qualified regional centers. Let me try to state it that way. Clearly, if you file a direct investment and you have the money and you will be directing that entity and so forth, it's safer, but there's risk there of businesses failing as well. So I think that that's, and since the amounts are a lot higher now, 800 or 1,050,000 and the TEA stuff, you know, that's a decision that really needs to be made between the lawyer and the investor with all the pros and cons and risk associated with that. Again, you know, one of the things that scares me about the new law is, when do I know whether I'm in a TEA?
Yeah. Yes.
I like the environment where I had a safe harbor because my state gave me something saying I'm in a TEA. Now, when do I get to know whether I'm really in a TEA and whether my 800 is okay? Now, there's educated guesses about it, but until USCIS makes the final determination, do I have 100% certainty? I don't think you do have 100% certainty.
Ron and John, there has been a lot said about Senator Grassley, both in comments preceding the litigation and during the litigation. And I really felt like Judge Chhabra really dismissed all of that and really dismissed Senator Grassley's views, talking about that little speech he gave from the Senate floor.
I don't think it was done at the Senate floor. I thought it was beautiful in the decision. I think it dispelled it. As being, I mean, on page 8, he talks about the agency poison statement by Senator Charles Grassley. And it discusses that the government initially asserted that he made the statement on the Senate floor, but the congressional record is unclear on that question. So I think Grassley regrets not making it on the Senate floor and saying, this is what I wanted. I think he was trying to cure it afterwards. What I thought was also surprising, though, is the government conceding that during the lapse, only Section 610B lapsed, not 16A, because there was going to be litigation in that arena as well, had the new law not passed.
What do you mean by 16B, 16A for our listeners, John?
Well, 16A created the regional center, but 16B then had a set aside, and there was going to be litigation, and there was litigation filed, and I think Baring actually had filed litigation on that area as well, saying, you know what? The regional center was not lapsed. The set aside was lapsed, but not the regional center itself under 610, because that did not have a sunset date. And I was kind of shocked to read the decision where the government apparently conceded that in oral arguments in this case.
Yeah, the government kind of painted itself into a corner and didn't know how to get out. They had to justify why it was that regional centers, after June 30, 2021, were required to file annual statements with filing fees if the program ended, and if the end of the program terminated the regional centers. So in order to justify the annual statements and accepting the fees, they had to say, well, Section 610A allowed them to, somehow the program continued, but just there weren't any visa numbers authorized or set aside. Well, so you're saying that the regional center program continued to exist, the regional centers continued to be designated after the program expired, but now as soon as Congress reauthorized the program, the regional centers lost their designation? But that's the corner they painted themselves into.
I was shocked because the bottom line is this, a set aside only means, okay, it'll be 3,000 or whatever the number was that our regional center out of the 10,000 or the whole quota for EB-5.
Yeah.
So if 610 never ceased to exist, they still had the pool from the 10,000.
Yeah, and they had no basis to refuse to adjudicate I-526 petitions.
Correct. Or accept new ones, or
right.
They didn't. So I was shocked of that concession. But again, that shows to me, obviously, that the agency doesn't really think through these things. And unfortunately, although I wish they'll start being more reasonable, you know, hopefully they'll start providing more guidance in order to know what the rules of the road are, so we can properly advise people to invest on and which one provides a greater likelihood of success.
Ron, and of course, John, what do you suggest we tell developers who want to file new regional centers?
That, to me, Mona, is pretty clear. Decision of the judge has nothing to do with that. So if you were never an approved regional center, this litigation doesn't make you an approved regional center. So the Immigration Service, under the Reform and Integrity Act, has every right to say, if you want to become a regional center, you have to apply. And they can certainly use the I-956 as that form, and that you can't proceed with filing for a project until you're an approved regional center. So I think, again, our litigation has nothing to do with that. For if you want to become a new regional center, you do what we thought you were going to do anyway, which is file a 956F, not file 956, wait for the approval, and then file a 956F for your project.
I completely agree with what Ron said. I mean, I think that the scheme they devise still applies to someone that wants to do new projects and be a new regional center. I think, as the judge put it, become a member of the club. But if you're a member of the club already, obviously they have to enact answer some of these questions on what the policies are going to be going forward to that. If you were a member of the club already, you could show compliance with the new requirements.
Well, I think it's a very expensive fee for this club, but what they say is all well that ends well. Ron, John, I have nothing but respect for the talents and for the perseverance that you have as being members of this very special club.
I think the gratifying part of this is that as soon as the Immigration Service decided to shut the doors on 630 businesses, we all thought that was wrong. And as lawyers, we thought that it was legally wrong. And this is a good example of where we were able to present those views and a judge totally agreed with us. And, you know, I'm very excited. I think that it's been a long time since the EB-5 industry is, has as promising a future as it has now. It's been many years where we've been dealing with 3-month extensions and 6-month extensions. And now we have a long-term extension, and we have a new law that provides lots of investor protections, which we're all concerned about also. And we have a green light from the judge to move forward. So it's an exciting time.
Yeah, it's a tremendous victory for the industry of going forward. And there's a more of a clear roadmap of, you know, for the existing regional centers and new regional centers that want to be a member of the club in order to comply and have all the new safety protections for investors and projects.
Well, John Pratt and Ron Glasgow, thank you so much for coming back on EB-5 Investment Voice. And thank you for fighting the good fight. Ron, I know you've been doing this for over 3 decades. Thank you both for fighting the good fight, not just for these American businesses, for American jobs, as well as foreign and money coming into the United States to help fund this. I'm glad you guys fought it so it didn't shut down. It's continuing to go. So thank you for coming on the show, and thank you for all the work you do.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshawlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.